Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 27th, 2005. This session is Daily Work and Christian Vocation, presented by Lynn Rhodes in the Fireside Room. Disc number RHL 2005-01.
Who I am a little further when I'd like to have you also introduce yourself quickly, but in an important way for me. I want to say that this issue of vocation and daily work, in some ways, after being here a couple of days, seems as though I'm talking about issues that you have already dealt with in many, many ways. I am a seminary professor, and I teach seminarians who are preparing to be pastors in local churches. And it's what's called a non-denominational seminary. But it's largely mainline Protestant. That's how you can understand what we do. We have almost 30 denominations, but most of them are United Church of Christ, Methodist, Presbyterians, Disciples. We get the Lutherans who can't be ordained to come to our school. We have a Center for Gay and Lesbian Studies. So we also get people in different denominations who can't get ordained in their own but want to prepare for their ministries. And it's out of that work with seminarians that a lot of my initial research into the subject of work began. And I'll also talk a little bit more about that in the following days. But I assume that everyone here assumes that Christian vocation is something you're all called to. That the songs we sang last night talked about all of us being the body of Christ. And the hymns, the way that the Eucharist was celebrated, not by the pastor standing up, but by all of us reading the words of institution. All of those things that Holden sort of holds forth are in some senses the things that I daily encounter that I would like people to have had a Holden experience in the churches that I work with. So to say that I recognize that with this group of people. But I do want to look at how our theologies of vocation have shaped our actual practices in today's world of work. And I think there's some very serious problems with that. And I want to talk about that a little. And today I want to talk about the vocation issue. And tomorrow I want to look about the issues of work life, especially in the United States, and especially in the midst of our present economic life and what is happening, how people experience their daily work life. And the third session, I want to look at spirituality and work. I don't know if you've noticed, but in the last 10 years, booksellers tell me that one of the most prolific developments in the book world are on books on spirituality and work. It's just blooming. And again, I want to say I have a very serious critique of those books, of a majority of them. And so I want to talk about that, not because I don't think it's critical, but because I want to talk about how work shapes us spiritually, not how we shape work. I think it's the daily practice that forms us probably more than anything else that we do. And I want to talk about how that shapes us. And then the fourth session, the relationship of our daily work to the work of the world. How does our daily work relate to the immense suffering in our world and yet to the good news of abundant life? How do we put that together? And the last one then is, how do we in our congregations and communities of faith, I would suggest we have some emphases and ways of working in the church that might change dramatically if we understand that the primary vocation is the vocation of the congregants, not of the pastors. And that we as pastors are secondary. And if you want to call it, the highest calling is not ours. So I'd like to talk about some of that and what the implication is in the way that we can conduct church life. So those are the five things that I'd like to talk about, and they're all interrelated. And I was trying to sort out, they said, you know, each session was in itself a complete session, so you can come and go, which is what I did the one time I came here, where I was interested. But each of these are so interrelated to each other. I hope I can make each session its own thing. But what I'd like to do now is, I don't know, it might take the whole hour if we went around the room, but maybe I want you to think with me about your childhood understanding of work. What did you as a child think work was about? What was conveyed by your parents or your own experiences of work? And if you have just any immediate images that come to mind, kind of call them out, or metaphors, or what you learned about work as a child. What did you think it was? Any images or anything?
I just remember I was going to be a nurse or a teacher, because again, that was the only choices.
You knew what your choices were.
Well, yeah, but I was going to be one of them, which probably said something that I was planning to work.
Did you know you were going to be a worker at some point?
Constant.
Mm-hmm. Work as constant.
Always doing something productive.
Always necessary for survival.
Necessary for survival. Yes.
I think earn a living.
I'm sorry, what?
Earn a living,
right.
I grew up on a small, diversified farm in Minnesota, and work just seemed to be the whole life. I mean, it wasn't like you worked certain hours. It was just part of whole life.
You didn't go to work. You were a worker.
You were always at work, and yet you weren't always at work. I mean, if you decided to go fishing for an hour, you could do that, assuming the cattle didn't need to be fed right then or so on. But it was more of a total life involvement.
So it wasn't separated from the rest of your life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any others?
It's a drudgery.
Drudgery.
What I was exposed to as a child, my father was forced to do work that he didn't, was certainly no better than supporting kids.
Yeah. Those of us who were the children of the Depression parents, especially, I think, learned a lot about what was work and what it meant not to be able to find work. And with fear. Yes?
A commitment.
Commitment.
Work was something that everyone was expected to do as soon as you were, I grew up on a farm, so work, the first image was physical work. You were intended to start working, and it was something that, since it was something that everyone did, it was also expected that you do it well.
Yeah.
The work you could do gauged your worth as a person. Mm-hmm.
Worth as a person, yeah.
It was something that you did when you grew up. You were asked as a child, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a firefighter, I want to be a doctor. It wasn't something that could happen before you were grown up.
My nieces and nephews have really incorporated that message. Work.
I think I'm from the old generation too, where, I mean, as a child, you were taught things for survival that was work, but it was necessary to know those things. And you learned them at a young age. You didn't wait until you were a teenager or out of the house.
Yeah.
You helped mom or you helped dad whenever they needed it.
Yes, one of my earliest memories is my father putting bills out. I must have been seven. Wasn't older than seven. And showing us the bills and saying how much he made and what happened between those two things. We were very impressed. Remember, right after that, my brother was sent down to buy some nails. And the guy at the store said, well, what kind of nails do you need? And my brother said, the cheapest. That's what he got out of that lesson. Yes.
You know, even though my parents out of the Depression, too, and did what they had to do, I got this other message from my father particularly, which was do what you enjoy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Money that for us.
Yeah.
Even if that wasn't really what he got to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
my mother did kind of get to do something. She died, but not completely. She had to give up something else. So they had a hope for us that wasn't exactly what they were
what they were living out. I think there are a lot of parents who have that hope for their children. One of my earliest recollections, also, which I think has probably influenced my approach to this, is the day I realized as a young child that work was not fair. Mm-hmm. We had gone on vacation and we were watching a canal worker raise and lower the docks, and he had this cute little house. And he was sitting there reading in the sunshine with flowers, and all of a sudden the little boat would come along. Then he would go out and he would lift the, you know, fill the lock and all that. And then they would go sailing on through, and he would chat with them as they were going through, and then he would go back and read. And I was raised in a mill town. And I knew what the mill workers made. And I thought, he's just sitting there in the sunshine, enjoying himself, talking to people, raising and lowering this thing every once in a while. This life is not fair. And work is not fair. There is something, you know, I early on learned this issue about work and fairness that really, the other thing was the image on my church, the image of Jesus, in the front was a stained glass window of Jesus in Gethsemane praying, and the thing underneath said, "Thy will be done." And that was for me that I would have to do God's will, mm-hmm. and that God's will would be sacrifice. So I thought as a child that I had to go to a country that had snakes and work with people that lived amid snakes. I was terrified of snakes, and I'm sure then, since that was the thing I feared the most, that's where I was going to have to go through. So it's very interesting how we develop these concepts of what is work like and what's its meaning, and then what relationship does it have to vocation? Yes.
Yeah, I was just sitting thinking about this. My mother was on kind of an assisted pension because my father died when I was only six. And I'm thinking, on the one hand, you know, we were taught work at an early age. Work to keep the house looking nice, work to keep the yard up, work to, what was the other one I had? But anyway, but there was a kind of a difference in my mind between work and a job. A job is what you would get, and you would have money coming in, and maybe could better your house, better your car, that type of thing. But you still did work, and whatever, when you did even a job around the house, you did your best that you could. But it was totally different than leaving and going to work at a job.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Job, work, mm-hmm. what they all mean. Well, I think all these things rattle around in our heads and inform and shape the ways that we really listen to what is said in church about vocation and how it relates then to our daily work life. That's the question. How does it relate to the work that we do every day? And what, again, think about what biblical images you have about work. Did you get a clear image of what work meant from biblical stories? I would say that mostly biblical stories are about blessing or curse. Work might be a blessing, or work might be a curse. Original sin, Adam and Eve, were going to be cursed by having to work. Sweat of the brow and the pain of childbirth. That was our going to be what we got from the world as the consequence of sin. On the other hand, the lilies of the field, you know, they toil not, and yet they reflect God's glory. All kinds of biblical images. So looking at scripture is very difficult in trying to understand what are the things about work. Also, 1 Corinthians 7:20, according to Louisa Schoncroft, has been a New Testament scholar who's been at my school for the last 5 years. She, I don't know if you know Dorothea Zola's name, who's also, both of them were early German feminist scholars, and they were best friends. And Louisa grew up during Nazi Germany. Her father was a confessing church pastor. And they hid Jews in their home, and so she's
as a New Testament scholar and as a feminist, has struggled all her life with the meaning of the New Testament and how it has been used to in ways that have done people in, I guess. As a woman, as a person very clearly aware of anti-Semitism, of all things. And she says that 1 Corinthians 7:20, which says, has been used historically in ways that have had devastating consequences for lots of people. And it goes, I have it right here. Let each of you remain in the condition in which you were called. Or often translated, in the state to which you were called. If you were a slave, do not be concerned about it. For whoever was called as a slave is a freed person belonging to the Lord, etc. And it goes on, but it doesn't say anything about what it means to be in that condition. Whether it's been used to keep women as housewives, people out of ordained ministry, out of all kinds of things. It's been very static, and she said the word is klesis, which really means called. So the way she understands that is, let each of you remain in the calling to which you were called. In other words, it's the call of God, not the condition that we need to be aware of. But biblically, it's a very uneven history about what we've learned from the Bible. And so I want to give a little, first of all, a little introduction to how a Christian vocation has been understood over time, and then give my view of a Christian vocation, and then we can talk about it. And I have put up here a quote by Adrian Rich that says, for those of you who can't read it because of the light, the problem, unstated till now, is how to live in a damaged body in a world where pain is meant to be gagged, uncured, ungrieved over. The problem is to connect, without hysteria, the pain of anyone's body with the pain of the body's world. That for me is sort of profoundly affected my way of understanding work. And I'll talk about what I think we're saying. If we say Christian thing, the vision is how to live in damaged bodies, in a damaged world. And how does that vision then, not the problem, connect without hysteria the pain of our own bodies with the pain of the world? I think one of the issues about work that is deepest is that we are really afraid that if we look at the reality of work, not only that we do, but the world does, and whether it damages or heals bodies, we would die by letting that much pain into us. I mean, turn off the TV, I can't stand anymore. And what she is saying, and I think what the gospel says, is that our pain, when we connect it without hysteria, I always like that little one, to the pain of the body's world, we will then begin to heal. So historically, to say in the early Christian community, especially in the biblical stories of the early Christian communities, the overwhelming understanding was that this was a small, persecuted group that decided, in order to survive, they needed to share everything in common. That was the first thing they needed to do. And the second thing they needed to do was to witness to what they had heard and seen. So those were the two tasks of the community. No division of labor, no one doing one thing or another. Everybody accountable to the same two things: witnessing to what they had experienced, and caring for one another, sharing everything in common. One of the things I love in the New Testament is this statement. At one point, where some of the disciples and some of the followers began to think that all they needed to do was to spread the good news, and they forgot about feeding the widows. And they were called to account. They were not fulfilling their call because they were forgetting about the widows and those who were in need. So what they did was divide up labor. I always love this. So they decided that some people should stay home and take care of the widows, and that the others could go out and spread the gospel. But I think sometimes, I think we still got that division going on, and some of us are going to go out and do the significant work, and the rest are supposed to stay home and take care of the widows. But in that sense then, those early Christian communities were not really interested necessarily in what call was about. But it was only in the development of the institutional church and in the division into religious work and ordinary work. And that happened after the first communities, when people began to have to recount the story and they wanted to get it right, and it began to require those who could read, those who could write, those who had some education. And most people, as within today's world is the same, most people worked to survive. I mean, work was to survive. You did what you did because you needed to do it. So that became what the ordinary people did, and the religious people then did the work of carrying on the story correctly, making sure it was heard as it should be heard, and in praying and meditation and communion with God. And the ordinary people just didn't have the time for that. So that division into religious and ordinary life began. And again, that's a thread that has continued down to the present day. The religious workers and the ordinary workers. And that's, and in that then, that after that then, it was also true that most people had no choice about work. So it wasn't, what kind of work should I do? That wasn't the issue. And as this developed, and the monasteries developed, and as all of this division between religious workers and ordinary workers, of course, those of you who are Lutheran, I'm Methodist, so I'm not. Remember Luther, as we all do, and his rebellion against this division. And what he was rebelling against when he talked about the priesthood of all believers was not about religious versus ordinary work so much as about mediation, that we all were priests when it came to our relationship to God. There could be nobody between us and God. And that's the priesthood of all believers. The second thing that he did was to say that all work had dignity, because he understood the world order to be God's world order. And things that were happening, and the way the order of the world was constructed was under God's control. And so he wasn't asking to change the way work was done. He was giving it dignity because God had ordained it. So the farmer had dignity in providing the food, the housewife and cleaning. And what he wanted to do was to restore that sense of dignity to ordinary work, and to counter the idea that there had to be somebody between us and God as mediators. But he was also at the beginning, the first beginning development of the Industrial Revolution. So Luther was also very conservative in the aspect of not really challenging the world order as it was. He thought kings should remain kings, and farmers should remain farmers, and peasants should remain peasants. But that you should have good kings, and good peasants, and good farmers. And so the emphasis was on how you did your role. You could do it, so it was not to the glory of God. But it wasn't changing roles. Well, in the Industrial Revolution, as you know, work was changing rapidly. And so it came up against some really critical issues in which his ideas then began to be used to keep people in their place when they rebelled. So though he broke with the tradition of separating religious and ordinary life, he also created an environment where, also developed an understanding of vocation that then began to be used against people who began to rebel about their place and their work. Now, Calvin was even more adamant about this, and I want to just read Calvin's, a little bit about Calvin. He said, in the story of Mary and Martha, which up to that point had been an allegory about the better work, that contemplation was the better work. And I want to say that that strand still comes down to us. There's still some sense that the contemplative life is somehow closer to God than the active life. But he said this was not a story of the better life, but of timing. That Martha picked the wrong time to cook the food. That was the problem. Not that the food didn't need to be cooked. And then he went on to say something that he said, when some men, and this was his, of course, his response to the Catholicism of that period, when some men were driven by ambition to withdraw from the ordinary intercourse of life, or when peevish men gave themselves up to solitude and indolence, the resolution to adopt that course was followed by such pride that they imagined themselves to be like the angels because they did nothing. For they entertained as great a contempt for active life as if it had kept them back from heaven. On the contrary, we know that men were created for the express purpose of being employed in labor of various kinds, and that no sacrifice is more pleasing to God than when every man applies diligently to his own calling and endeavors to live in such a manner as to contribute to the general advantage. When a man works in his labor to earn his living, when a woman does her housework, and when a servant does his duty, one thinks that God does not pay attention to such things, and one says that they are secular affairs. Yes, it is true that such work is proper to this present and fleeting life. However, that does not mean that we must separate it from the service of God. So he's really trying to get this issue about work. John Wesley, of my tradition, I don't know if you've heard this before, work as hard as you can, earn as much as you can, give all you can. We Methodists did not know about grace at all. My father said when someone said, when a preacher was preaching one time and started praying about we sinful people, you know, for the grace of God, for the grace of God. And my father looked up and said, if he is such a sinner, why doesn't he get out and do something about it? That was sort of our thing. If you feel so sinful, don't just sit there and you wail. So that was the Wesley part of me. And then what that began to develop, and think about all these things as they begin to develop, it takes little character to do difficult things if you like to do them. It takes a lot of character to do things that are tiresome, monotonous, and unpleasant. That understanding of work, if it's hard and unpleasant, then it's, you know, that's when your character shows up. That's when you really got good character. Now, all of this, of course, led to a lot of theories about good workers as the foundation for the new Industrial Revolution. And the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. Many of you may have heard of that thing. The Protestant work ethic. God calls us to be good workers. It became identified in the United States with the spirit of capitalism and democracy, and this process, especially the Protestant main, what our old main line, since we're no longer main line, mm-hmm. Protestant old main line identification with this particular economic system and democracy began to shape our work ethic and understanding of vocation and what a good human being is really supposed to be. Good worker, good human being, good Christian. So many of these ideas that have been filtered down in different ways, some of them that I think continue to sort of operate, at maybe it's sometimes at subconscious levels, that first of all, work is affirmed. It's not demeaning to do manual labor or ordinary work. That is. I remember the little prayer books we used to get, you know, praying while you're washing the dishes. That was given to the girls. work is an obligation. To be idle is bad. Work is service to neighbor. That's what Calvin and Luther always emphasized, was that work was service to neighbor. What it became in capitalism, work is good, makes you a good human being without the little added service to neighbor necessarily attached to it. That work, some work is not compatible, mostly has to do with personal morality issues. You shouldn't be a prostitute, you shouldn't practice usury, you shouldn't do certain kinds of things. But within the United States context particularly, most work is okay to do. It's not questioned as being the work in itself, as not being work that a Christian can do. Now, of course, I was being raised as a Methodist, and I say too, the first time as a kid that I went to Nevada, I saw a Methodist church. And I said, Mom, there can't be any Methodist churches in Nevada. And she said, why not? I said, well, everybody in Nevada works in the gambling industry. And we know that as Methodists, none of us can gamble. That was, you know, you don't drink, you don't smoke, and you don't gamble. We had Sundays that told us that over and over. So when I saw Methodist churches in Nevada, I thought, this cannot be. They can't do that kind of work. Work is a discipline that shapes character. That's another one. Continuation and a continuation of the separation of religious work and ordinary work. I've been in China several times, and the Christians in China are honored most by the Chinese government because they are good workers. And one of the messages that's given to Christians over and over in China in order to be acceptable in that culture is that what they contribute to the culture is this sense that a Christian is a good, honest, effective worker. And that's highly valued in China. And that's, the government sees that as one of the contributions of Christianity. That we still have this higher calling to religious work, what we call clericalism, this idea that somehow call to religious work is a higher call. We have individualistic understanding of call as personal relationship to God, that we ask people, have you been called? Identification of work with a particular economic system, that Christianity and forms and capitalism as a, we say form, not necessarily as it's practiced, are seen to be compatible. And in fact, if you try to question one, you're liable to be seen as denying the other. Now, so what I want to what I want to say, let me see, we start this 3:45 to 4:45. I want to talk about six things as a theology, and I want to sort of just do them very quickly, and then I want to get your reactions to them. A theology of vocation for our time and place. Number one is God's call is given to all, beyond Christians.
God's call is given to the whole world. And it is given, period. It's already been given. There's no doubt about it. It's given. So the second thing is that for Christians, we acknowledge that call in our baptism. And that's where we respond to the call. We have always been called. So when someone says, have you been called? That's an irrelevant question. Yes, you have all been called, period. That's already been decided. But we acknowledge and take up our understanding and working, discerning of what that call means when through our baptism. That's understanding of call and baptism. For Christians, then, the call is communal, and it is the same for everyone. We have no different call. We've all called to the same thing. And that call is stated in many ways: to love self, neighbor, and God, to serve, to work for justice, to feed the hungry, to visit prisoners, to all of those things that have come out. We're all called to that, period. There's no special call. I want to talk about that. Ask me about why I say that. And at the same time, each person has a unique and necessary gift for the common call. God gives each person a special message to deliver, a special song to sing, a special love to give, special acts, and that no one else can give that. It is unique to each one of us. But in order for us to live out that call, we all are engaged together, because the call itself is larger than our particular place in it. But when that place is not there, it's like the body of Christ, there is a wound. And we are connected to that wound. So it is both that the call is communal and the same, and that each person takes up a particular part of that call, and without them, we suffer. It goes back to this issue I have on the board here. That the broken body of Christ is in God's broken world at this point, and that's the tragedy and the sadness of this world, is how few of us get to live out any sense of the fullness of God's call. Partly because to live out the fullness of God's call only will occur when all of us can live it out fully. What do you think about that? So when someone says, you know, we're too interconnected, our bodies are too permeable for us to think that we can live out the call in God's broken world and as a part of Christ's broken body until that body is healed. So that's part of what the call is together to make those connections so that all of our parts of that call are strengthened and given to the body. The issue then is discernment, not call. You're all called, period. You don't have to worry about that. The issue is discernment. And the reason this is so important for me is, again, going back to seminary, I have people who come to seminary and say, I want to be a pastor. I had one guy who wanted to be in pastoral care. There was not a single person in that seminary that wanted to talk to him. He had no listening skills. He had no empathy. He had nothing that would give him counseling, to be a good counselor. But when I tried to talk with him about where he might really express his gifts for God, he only heard that I was denying his call because of this sense, of this individualistic sense of call that, and because the church had told him over and over about the real call is to religious life. So if he wasn't called to be a pastor, then we were denying him the right to participate in the highest form of God's call. Second of all is that most people in this world, their daily work is to survive. And when someone says to me, God called me, and I made it to seminary, and God's special call is what put me here. I want to say, and how many thousands of people who had the same call that you got never made it here? Because they didn't have the education, because they didn't have the money, they didn't have the opportunity. If it was only, quote, God's call that got you here, then most of the world is condemned. Or call becomes very elitist. It only refers to those who have options. So call is a discernment about time, the needs of the time. It also concerns your gifts. It concerns your responsibilities. If you have children to feed, if you have accountabilities to other people, call then is discerning, is the discerning of how to live out God's call in your particular time with the particular issues and concerns that you have. And the final thing, clericalism. I think that our practices, as that come over years of thinking about that, and as ordained myself, I think that ordination is probably a heresy. That until such time as we can ordain everybody to the work that they have begun to discern and the community has begun to discern is somehow fulfilling their needs. We keep setting up practices that continually tell people what it is to be really called and the highest form of call. So I think we have to seriously think. Clericalism has just persists and persists, even among those of us who try to work against it. And I think it's because of the practices of the church. I remember when I was ordained, my friends came up to me and they said, you know, this is a really hard, sad day for us. Church got you up there, put robes on you, put a stole on you, put their hands on you, said, wow, isn't this something? You know, you're called to this high thing. We've been doing our damnedest all of our lives, and have the church recognized our work? No. Have they paraded us up and down, put stoles on us? No. So we don't believe it when the church says your work is important. We know by what the church does who they think is really doing significant work. So these are things that I think that really need to be thought about as we think about call and how it relates to the daily work. To be a pastor is critical work. I'm not denying that at all. But it is just one work. And it has its ups and downs and its weirdnesses, I didn't tell you.
Yes. There's a liturgical connection here that I've read about recently that helped me conceptualize this business of clericalization, and that, you know, the early church's baptisms, the records that we have, they were taking everyone and parading them around and drenching them with luxurious oil, dressing them in these beautiful robes, and, you know, this incredibly immense celebration. There's some evidence that as baptisms got less and less extravagant, became more of these kind of just get the kid done and blah, blah, blah. That's when the kind of the bigness of ordinations began to rise up. And so there's some thoughts in the liturgical movement that if we could return more to the beauty and dignity of baptism, which is utterly egalitarian, there would be kind of a natural way of reducing clericalism. Ordination is making you really Christian or something.
Right. Yeah. I think I was fascinated this morning. You're talking about baptism, and you know, I think there is. I think the practices that we carry on tell people more about what we really believe. Yes. Somebody wants to say something else. Okay. Those are my little statements. Vocation. Any things that you want to say that challenge that, or like to talk about it more in terms of what it means in terms of vocation? Yes.
Well, I was
just going to say, because I work with our pastor on a daily basis, and I think it might partly be the structure, but I also think it's the congregation, because they pile a lot on him. They look to him. They accept Ed. He's very human. I mean, he really, you know, he bears his soul. No, he's a wonderful man. But, I mean, he does not place himself apart from them. But they do, I think. I mean, and I watch it sometimes, and the way people talk to him and the way they look to him to sort of, you know. I mean, I think we do look to other people for guidance and as a listening ear and all of that. But they do it in a way that sometimes I ask him, I said, how do you do this? How do you go home and not just, because I really struggle sometimes when I go home being on staff at church to leave it there. And he said, you have to leave it there. You cannot take this home. Your family will not survive. Your marriage will not survive. Actually, it's what he told me. But it's so hard. And to just kind of leave the church and leave it. I mean, I haven't succeeded at that yet. I have succeeded in not sharing anything with my husband, which is crucial. And so I think the congregation, I think people do that though too. They put them in a place apart.
It's a reinforcing
yeah.
kind of
I mean,
system
I think it's,
where people begin to act in certain kinds of ways and expect the pastor is going to be. The other thing is that most people who come to this, who are trained to be pastors are ordinary people. They're like Jesus' disciples.
Mm-hmm.
They're very ordinary. They're not particularly brilliant. And to think that they are going to provide you with a sermon each week that's going to just set you up, I've gone to lots of conferences about what is wrong with the church, and they're always talking about leadership. We've got to develop this leadership. So they add about 4 more tasks for pastors. You know, now I have to be skilled, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I just think that's, as you're saying, I think it's on both sides. It's just devastating to the individuals, and it's people begin to live in a relationship as congregants to.
And they don't do it on purpose. I mean, they care about him deeply. So that's what I say. I don't mean it to sound like, that's these two ladies are part of our congregation. And I got to thinking, oh, dear, oh gosh, wait, let me clarify that. But it just, it happens. I mean, we have one lady especially who has been away from the church, and now she just adores him on a level when I sit sometimes when she says stuff, and I thought, oh, don't do that to her. I mean, she means well, but I thought, oh, you know. So it's hard.
I think several of the things that you said I think are absolutely right on. One I'd like to push on a little bit
uh-huh.
more, though,
that'd be great.
Which is when you say, the whole world is called, we acknowledge this and come to understand it as Christians through our baptism, all of that I would agree with. Then when you say, we all have the same call, that's, you know, there are different ways of working with that vocabulary, so let's
right.
take that one. But then when you say, we each have a unique, I don't remember exactly, but each one is a unique thing to do. Yes, and at the same time, I think it's very important when we talk about vocation to talk about all our roles and responsibilities. So my set is unique,
mm-hmm.
and I have a particular set of gifts,
mm-hmm.
but I don't have just one. Or if I have
yeah.
one, it's the composite of many things. And I think that helps with our understanding of the church, and as you talked about it being a corporate thing, so that there's overlap, right? And the pastor has certain things to do that aren't mine to do. The pastors overlap with mine in a particular way because I'm trained as a theologian, but I'm not given that office. I have a different office. So I just think it's really, really important that we're careful to say vocation is composite. It's all my roles and responsibilities. So it's citizenship, it's parenthood, it's being a friend, a lover of poetry. I mean, all of those things are part of, not just one.
Yeah. And what I meant by unique is not that it's you're right. I mean, it helped to clarify what I was trying to say about that, is the idea both that or the understanding that I have of what God's word is to us is that everyone is a beloved child of God.
Right.
And that everyone also is necessary.
Right.
Not only are we beloved, but we're necessary for the completeness mm-hmm. of life, and for that thing we talked about, the health of life. And that when one is denied, I suffer from the fact right. that person cannot live that out in the fullness in all ways, you know, not right. because it's one particular thing, but because of that interconnectedness of our bodies and the earth and each other, that the body image of Jesus is, you know, of the body of Christ is the that if one suffers, all suffers, if one rejoices, all rejoices. Is in our individualistic culture very hard to internalize bodily. And I think the reason a lot of us don't want to is because we have a lot more control over our lives, most of us in the United States, than most people do. And if we really thought that we were connected to them, it would be, you know, we would think that we would be done in. if that pain of that pain. But I'm also saying that joy from the others is what keeps me able to do what I can do.
But the other thing, there's the individualism, but there's also a specialization that we want to say, my vocation is that I am a college professor. Well,
no.
But I, you know, I'm not always going to do that. And I, you know, I think of when you asked us about work, and somebody talked to you about value, I thought of my grandmother when she got sick and saying she couldn't do anything for anyone. You know, and that notion that the doing is the vocation rather than the being, which takes various, which flows out in a whole bunch of ways, is very, very essential, I think, particularly to Luther's teaching, properly understood. Which means how I understand.
That's why I said that our calling, I mean, that discernment is the issue.
Yeah.
And discernment doesn't have to do with just gifts. It
right.
has to do with the times.
Right.
I mean, when I remember being in the Philippines and with a woman who has had seven children, and every day they went out to try this at Marcos regime. And every day she had to say to her children, I may not make it back alive tonight. And she did that not because that's what she wanted to do,
right.
but because she saw no other option at that time historically. That wasn't her particular gift. That wasn't her, you know. She had responsibilities and accountabilities, but in order for her children to survive, she had to risk her life every day. Whether or not that was what she wanted
right.
to do or felt gifted to do.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to get at, is this,
right.
this sort of unique, you know, Wigner is right in one sense when he says, what's that famous saying about when the joy of my
grace
meets the needs of the world. Well, part of me says, crap. Because it's not, that may never happen.
Yeah, and
that doesn't mean that I'm not living out the fullness.
Right.
That's sort of what, yeah.
Then I'm wondering if you're going to talk at all about the whole concept of women's work. And I'm in this transition of I've left the full-time work field where I make money for a living and have chosen and feel called to be at home. And most of the time when you're out and about socially, the question starts with, what do you do? And that usually means, where do you work and how much money, you know, where do you get your money from? So I've been making things up. Like I'm the president of Us Incorporated. I'm an investment and estate manager. You know, I have a checkbook and a house that I manage, or I'm a domestic goddess, or you know, it's kind of fumbling when you're called to something, but it's not in the traditional sense of a work 9 to 5 and money. But I'm just curious about that journey and
people who are on that, men and women that are on
yeah,
that journey.
But especially. Tomorrow, I'd really like to look at that a little more because of looking at work life. I want to, one of the underlying things I want to talk about tomorrow is that there is no higher call than seeing that the children of our world are fed. And this idea that the mundane baking the bread and taking care of children or seeing that they're fed and clothed and housed is something you do and then you go on to something that's more, is we ought to reverse that. Until such time as every child is fed, there is no higher calling in our world. So flip that over. Instead of saying there's something else out there, that at this point in our history, with the number of children who die every day from lack of food, there is no higher calling. And that says something to, you know, our own children and how our work life has made it harder and harder for us to relate to even the children that we love most dearly. So, okay. We have that. Yes.
A community that I've been part of for a while is struggling a lot with that last point you made on clericalism. And one of the thoughts that's come to us is whether ordination needs to be for a lifetime. Or can you be ordained in a community? And can we all get sort of commissioned, ordained, whatever the word is, for different things? And so maybe it's not getting rid of ordination, but office, you know, ordained for the office of pastor, ordained for the office of pastoral care minister, the presider. You know, we kind of imagine this possibility that all the services in the community could have some kind of, kind of maybe out of your baptism become this. And then you might do it for a period of time, and then you do your discernment, and then other people, it shifts around.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see if other communities are talking about that or
Well, in the Presbyterian Church, there are several ordinations. There's the ordination, you know, the most common one that everyone knows is the, you know, ordination of pastor, but there's also ordination to elder, and there's ordination, you know, that are, these are, you don't need to go to seminary, this is, you know, nowadays it's, you know, whoever's available, you know, then they're ordained. But also then it's ordination, and the ordination ceremony is in the Presbyterian Church, that whether it's for a pastor, whether it's for elder, you know, any of the, you know, the offices, you know, leaders of the church, whether that, you know, is a single person or a group of people, in the ordination ceremonies, then everyone who has ever been ordained to absolutely anything in any denomination will come forward and lay hands on the person who is being ordained as well. So it's definitely, it's, you know, and the Presbyterian Church ideally does not see these different ordinations as being, you know, hierarchical, but they're saying that some people are ordained to do this and some people are ordained to do that, and they respect all, and, you know, so any, that also reflects itself in the ceremony as well, and that anyone who has ever been ordained to do anything can go forward to lay hands on people who are to be ordained, so.
Yes. I'm going to try to do this a little bit differently. Partly in our culture, this whole individualism, sometimes we can see being vested with any really kind of honored task as about the individual, you know, and the bolstering of the individual. And probably many of us seek such things out of that hunger to be admired and so on. But if you think of the character of that, of the pastoral office or of many other offices, you know, rightly done, you can turn it on its head and say, you know, this is the ultimate life for others, right? Which is going to lead to being unappreciated more times than not, right? You know, I mean, so that there's a, if it's really being done for the sake of a communal whole, it's a different thing than if it's being done for the sake of the self, you know, building up the self. So I mean, so maybe something about the need to, you know, to rightly understand all the nature of, you know, word and sacrament ministry as a not as a elevated thing as much as a, you know, really hard and self-emptying thing.
Well, but then when you start thinking about it as the ultimate service,
yes,
then other people aren't doing the ultimate service.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always to me the issue about how
even that can become a kind of sacrifice that is not called for. It's not, I am not on behalf of the community. It is, I am one of the community and I am limited. Mm-hmm. I think what I see in people is either they get into the self-sacrificing thing where they are whoever, you know, whatever the world demands, they're going to serve it. Or because it takes so much out of them, they cling to the specialness of it as a way, as an ordinary human being, to survive. At least I'm doing something that is really central to God's work. And so therefore, if it's hard and demeaning or exhausting or has caused my marriage to dissolve or never see my kids or whatever kind of sacrifices people begin to, that's where I have this problem with the way it's set up by the church's practices, not by the theology. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I have read loads of material on ordination and the vocation of all Christians. Mm-hmm. And 99.9% of the time, I haven't found the other 1% yet, they will talk about, we'll have a paragraph about the importance of the vocation of all believers, and then we will have 42 chapters on ordination. And so that tells you where the real thought and process is about what it means. Now I'd like to say, is our primary work is the work in the world. It's not the work in the church. That the church nurtures that work. And when I go out and I'm not part of the church community, that's where I really need the discernment and what it means to be faithful there and what it means to carry out that message. It's sort of how do we do that so that we understand that in a way that is ritualized and honored and critiqued.
Sometimes yeah. I think that allowing people to be ordained and having ordination frees us because then those people do that and I don't have to. So that's a part of it too. It's not just that ordination is set aside that takes me off the hook and then I don't have to do anything, because if I really look at the world as everybody being called and then I am also called as a Christian to be a Christian and to do what I am to do in my location, that's a little too scary for a lot of people. So I think there's a flip side of that sometimes too.
I'm sorry, but I have to call the time. I have such an interesting response to that.